recognize Tina Albert, alcoholic. Really grateful to be here and be sober tonight. Welcome if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous. So he said I have until 9:55. Yeah, the room will empty out in about 20 minutes. I'm super grateful to be here and be sober tonight. And Kevin, thank you for asking me to come up and share with you guys this evening. I left like around noon, and I went through Lake Kachuma and had a little hike and spent some time with God because it seemed like a good thing to do today. And just spit it out there and let you guys know I'm having a rough patch this morning, this afternoon, and this evening. I dropped a really good friend of mine off at the car yesterday so he could take off and go to work. And he was going to come up here with me this weekend, and he never made it to work, and nobody's heard from him since. So I hate this frickin' thing that is alcoholism. I get to share with you guys in a general way what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today. And I'm exceptionally grateful that my story doesn't change a lot, because I could just turn my head on autopilot and let her rip, because I know how to do this. So I was the kind of kid that needed a drink long before I ever picked one up. I was restless, irritable, and discontented from the time that I could remember. And I was raised in Manhattan Beach. It's a little upper middle class beach community that way, a little way. And I remember going to school with all of these little girls that were like 5 foot tall, and they all had blue eyes and this long blonde hair and these bitchin' little surfer chick tans, and they were perfect. They looked like little prepubescent Pamela Andersons. And I was 5 foot eight when I was in the seventh grade, and I had long stringy red hair, buck teeth, and freckles. And I would look at these little girls and see perfection, and then I would look in the mirror and I felt like Pippi Longstocking on crack. And I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. And there was something wrong with me from the time that I could remember, and I couldn't put my finger on it and tell you what it was, but I just felt, I felt different, and I felt ill at ease, and I felt like I wasn't good enough or smart enough or pretty enough. And I would sit around the dinner table with my brothers and sisters and know that my mom loved them way more than she loved me, and I'm an only child, so that'll give you a little peek into the way that my brain works. I think entirely too much about myself, and that's always been problematic for me. But I just felt odd. And when I was in the seventh grade, I decided, my best friend Carrie told me that we were going to cut school, and we were going to go to her house, and we were going to drink scotch. And so we did that. I cut school and went over to her house, and we opened a scotch bottle, and my drinking career could have been written that day. I drank straight out of the bottle with no glass and no ice and no mixer. And that scotch burnt all the way down, and it burnt all the way back up, and it burnt when it came flying out my nose. It was just vile, nasty, horrible stuff, and I hated it. And I watched Carrie take a couple of drinks off that scotch bottle, and all of a sudden her face got pink, and she started giggling, and she wasn't worried about getting in trouble for cutting school. So I took the scotch bottle from her and I started chugging so I could catch up with her, and I did. In short order, I threw up all over her living room, and I had large memory gaps throughout the course of that afternoon, which you guys told me were something called blackouts, and I just thought it was whiskey. And about noon, my mom came banging on the door because the school had called, and we jumped out her bedroom window and climbed over the backyard fence, and I was off on Pippi's first grand adventure. And we had so much fun that afternoon. We climbed the water tower, and we were running through backyards and hiding in your dog houses, and I was running from the cops, and they weren't even chasing me. Like, it was just a great, great afternoon. And about 4 o'clock, I knew I couldn't go home, so I stole a bicycle from the continuation school. I wrapped a chain around my neck and stole a butcher knife from the kitchen for protection. And I was doing this Pippi Goes Chola phase when I was in the seventh grade. So I had, like, my hair was all ratted up in this Aquanet-looking helmet thing, and I was wearing these dicky pants with these little crip slips, and I was running all over Redondo Beach scribbling La Flaca R13 all over the walls. In pencil and whatever, and I stole this bicycle, and I took her 9-year-old brother and put him on the handlebars, and we ran away from home because it just seemed like the answer. And about 11 o'clock that night, I had pedaled us all the way up to East LA, where La Flaca didn't fit in too well either. And I called the police on myself, and they came and picked us up, and my mom was devastated. And somebody needed to snatch me up the next morning and just explain to me, like, why I shouldn't do that every single day for the rest of my life. For just a moment, I felt horrible. Like, I was watching my mom, and she was crying and just devastated. And I thought, like, oh, my God, how could I do that? And then a minute later, I just started thinking, like, what's the problem? Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, talks about this sense of ease and comfort that we get at once by taking a few drinks. And And I know what that sense of ease and comfort feels like. And goodness, come back, Tina, come back. But I called the police for the first and only time in my life on myself, and they picked us up. My mom was devastated, and the next morning I just wanted to do that again. And I was, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old when I was in the seventh grade, and I drank at every available opportunity. I loved the effect that I got from that drink of alcohol. Dr. Silkworth says that too, right? Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Like, duh. But I loved that sense of ease and comfort that I get. Like, I swear, looking back at that moment, it felt like my hair straightened and my teeth shrunk and my boobs grew. And everything that I thought was broken about me just seemed to melt into the background when I take a drink of alcohol. And I drank myself into and out of that middle school and into and out of MariCosta High School and into and out of Pacific Shores Continuation School and every single job that I ever got and every single relationship that I ever had. And when I was 17 years old, I was working at a Burger King because it was the best I could do. I had taken the California High School Proficiency Exam halfway through my sophomore year because I had no credits, and the counselor suggested I take this test and get my high school equivalency because there's no way I could graduate on time. And I was working at this Burger King, and my friends would come through the drive-thru window, and I would give them free food, and then they would give me free stuff. It just seemed like a great trade to me. And I was hanging out the drive-thru window drinking and smoking pot one day, and I turned around, and there was a United States Marine standing at the cash register in his dress blue uniform. And I don't know about the rest of you ladies, but I love a man in uniform. Started with, like, Cub Scouts, and then I like football players, and sanitation workers or grave diggers or, like, whatever. But I gave this guy my phone number, and he started calling me, and I went down to his office one day just to find out what he wanted, and it turned out that he was a United States Marine Corps recruiter. And if you don't know this, like, their sole intent is to recruit you. So I spun this sad tale of woe about why I was 17 with a proficiency certificate and working at Burger King. And I found out quickly Sergeant Dale Starkey had no intention whatsoever of recruiting me into his United States Marine Corps. So he took me next door to the Navy office, and I got off this bus December 21st of 1981. I was drunk from the plane ride cross country, and then we got on this bus. I had all of our service jackets of all the girls that were recruited to go to boot camp with me, and we get off the bus. We're all singing, like, in the Navy, and they're grabbing our stuff and screaming at us. It was dramatic, and I knew in the morning, as soon as I could speak with whomever was in charge, I'd be able to explain the nature of the mistake that had been made, and they would let me go home. And Navy boot camp doesn't work that way. And I was the youngest kid in my company. I was in trouble all the time, and so subsequently, so were you, because that's the way Navy boot camp works. They would, like, bellow my last name, and then you would do push-ups. So I had a lot of friends when I was in there. And I got in trouble 5 weeks, enlisted halfway through boot camp for drinking a six-pack of beer on my work week, and I met the commanding officer of the recruit training facility in Orlando and almost got kicked out. And then they sent me to A school in Pensacola, Florida, where I had my second captain's mask 5 months enlisted for drinking on a duty weekend and leaving base when I wasn't supposed to. Like, left to my own device, like our big book says, no matter how great the necessity or the wish, I don't have what it takes to not pick up a drink of alcohol. I hate it when I go to meetings and I hear people say, like, just don't drink no matter what. Like, on the surface, that sounds like a really nifty idea. But I drink no matter what, and so just don't drink no matter what is not like a solution for an alcoholic of my type. Like, I need something much more drastic than just don't drink no matter what. I need a message of recovery which has depth and weight. And I need some definitive actions that I could take that give me relief from the way that I think and I feel. Otherwise, I'm doomed. And I'm as clear about that today as I have ever been, unfortunately. And so I went off to A school in Pensacola. I had my second captain's mast for drinking when I wasn't supposed to. I lost a stripe and some money for a little while. I spent 14 days in the restricted barracks, and I was enlisted to be in naval intelligence, which should frighten you a lot. And all of these security clearances came through when I was in the restricted barracks, and I graduated with the class after mine, and they sent me to Adak, Alaska for my first duty station. And 1982 was the middle of the Cold War era, and we were spying on Russia. So that's where they sent people in naval intelligence. And I was secretary to the commanding officer of the Naval Security Group on ADAC. And I got to tell you guys, I loved being a sailor. I loved serving my country. I loved working for Captain Shivik. I loved my job. I loved wearing my uniform. There was no sense of pride like that I had ever had in my entire life like that. And the only problem was in 1982, the Navy started their zero tolerance policy, and I became their poster child. And so I was busted all the time for drinking, and they sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they put me on Anabuse. I decided one night that I would have Heineken on Anabuse, and I got through half a Heineken, and I threw up for 6 solid hours, and I was afraid I was going to die, and then I was afraid I wasn't, and I threw up forever, and I had this splotchy rash all over myself that I tried to explain away as the chicken pox, and because I'm a quick thinker, and I was so sick. And I went to that counselor, and he just looked at me, and he knew. And a couple weeks later, I started thinking, like, I didn't even get a buzz from that half a Heineken, and I'm sure my body's acclimated to the Anabuse by now, so maybe if I had a Coors Light, because it's almost water anyway, I'd be able to pull it off. And so I went over to the EM Club, and I ordered a double shot of Jack Daniels and a Coors Light, because if I was going to puke, I wanted to get drunk first. And so I drank the whiskey, and I had a seizure and woke up in the emergency room of that naval hospital. And I spent 21 days in a psych unit in Anchorage. I was supposed to be there for a little 72-hour observation, and they decided to keep me for a little while. And fully observed, I can assure you, they sent me back to that island with a recommendation that I be discharged from the military. And I begged my commanding officer for another shot. He sent me to Philadelphia to a rehabilitation program where I drank on Anabuse for the third time at a Sunday Phillies game and spray puked 5 rows of Philly Stadium, because I'm a lady when I'm drinking. And I just drank. I can't, there's in chapter 11 in the big book, it talks about not being able to imagine a life with alcohol or without it. And knowing loneliness such as few people do, and being at a jumping off place. And I wish I could tell you that on the 15th day of July in 1983, when I was discharged from the military, that I was at that jumping off place. And I thought perhaps I was when I left that rehab. I told my counselor I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to ask this nasty wench named Alice to be my sponsor, and I was going to do whatever it took to stay in the military. And he goes, "That's good, kid, but if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk." And I thought, like, I'm 18 years old, I'm too young to be an alcoholic, and I've never been homeless, and I haven't lost any family or children, never had a drunk driving, I've never been to jail, I've never lost any jobs. I don't know what I thought the Navy was. It's not just a job, it's an adventure. But I thought, like, you guys had done all of these things that I heard you guys talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hadn't done any of them. And I left that rehabilitation program convinced, like, every fiber of my being said that I was going to go to that neighborhood Alano Club and get a sponsor and stay sober and save my military career. And by noon, I was at the EM Club pitching quarters and drinking beer on Anabuse for the fourth time. And I spent the next 15 months drinking. Like, and I did every nasty, rotten, horrible, messed up thing that I swore I would never do that separated me from you guys. And on the 10th day of October in 1984, I was living in a 1971 MG Midget. I used to like to call it my roundabout townhouse, because when it would run, it would get me roundabout town. And when it didn't, I would just park it somewhere. And I had just stolen a 1.75 liter bottle of cheap vodka that was sitting in my den. And I hadn't even opened, somebody's listening, I hadn't even opened it yet. And like, my shoulders dropped a couple inches and that crick in my neck went away. And I knew that in a minute or an hour, whenever I made the decision to open that bottle and take a drink, that I was going to get that relief that I know that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I also knew that there was a good possibility that I was going to drive my car and harm myself or somebody else. And I also knew there was a good possibility that I was going to wake up in jail and not remember how I got there, or God willing, not remember how I got there. Most of the time I remembered, and that's horrible. Like, I used to shoot for blackouts, and I knew, like, that I would get that sense of ease and comfort. And I also knew that it was going to burn my life to the ground. And just like he was sitting there, I heard that counselor say, "Kid, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk." And I got out of my car and I worked the best first, second, and third step that I've worked in 31 and a half years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew to the core of my being that I was powerless over alcohol. And I also knew to the core of my being that my entire life was unmanageable. But for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought the first step said we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Somehow or another, tying the unmanageability of my life into my powerlessness over alcohol, I drank, and so therefore. And my current sponsor, when I was like 20-some years sober, goes, "There's no and in that step, kid. There's a dash." And that dash means end of one thought, beginning of a new one. And what that step really says is, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash, like the end. That our lives had become unmanageable. That's two separate thoughts. And the first half of that step means that we can't drink successfully. And the second half of that step means that we can't not drink successfully either. And Dr. Silkworth, in our doctor's opinion, says when he's talking about alcohol and drinking that this is repeated over and over again, that unless we can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of our recovery. And sitting in the car, like, I knew I couldn't drink and I knew I couldn't not drink either. And going to Alcoholics Anonymous, I believed perhaps, like, you guys might be able to restore me to some sort of sanity, at least where drinking was concerned. And I made a decision, which I followed up by some action, and I got out of the car and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they sent me across town to the Southwest Alano Club in Hawthorne. I walked into a 5:30 meeting. The topic was relationships, which was perfect because I was looking for a couple. And everybody in there had just gotten off work from, like, Northrop and TRW, and they were all dressed up, and they had their hair made up, and they all ranged in age from, like, 86 to 132, and I was 20. And I walked in there, and I heard this old man named Tom Wood say, "I'd like to welcome our new friends to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and let you know that you never have to pick up another drink for the rest of your life, 24 hours at a time." And I thought, like, old man, you only have 3 days left. Like, it's going to be a piece of cake for you. But I'm like 20. Like, I'm not even looking to never pick up another drink for the rest of my life. That's not the solution that I want from you. I just want to figure out how to stay sober for a little while, fix a couple things that I had broken, and then figure out how to drink until I was 86 like you, because it just didn't seem fair to me. And I walked into that meeting and I sat down, and you guys were so incredibly kind to me. This little old man named Olin bought me a big book, and you guys put all your phone numbers in there. I must have walked out of there with 20 phone numbers of people that I wouldn't call to put me out if I were on fire. Like, I was not. And I went to that 5:30 meeting, and then there was an 8:30 meeting right after it, and you guys made me stay for that. And then you took me to something that you called fellowship, and you bought me a $1.99 breakfast from this D's coffee shop and sat with me and drank coffee till 2 o'clock in the morning when I couldn't get any more liquor, and then you disappeared. rude. There were 4 meetings a day at that Alano Club, 6:45, 11:35, 30, and 8:30, and Gary would come out at 6 o'clock when he was making the coffee, and he would wake me up in the car that I lived in behind that Alano Club, and he would bring me in, and he bought me some soap and a toothbrush and some toothpaste, and He'd let me wash up and brush my teeth and then drink all the coffee and eat all the jelly donuts that I wanted before you guys got there for your little attitude adjustment meetings, where I would adjust your attitudes and then send you off to work in the aerospace industry. And then you'd come back for your little lunch meeting, and we'd have a 5:30 commuter meeting, and then you'd bring your little Al-Anon wives back for the 8:30 meeting. And I just went to 4 meetings a day and the fellowship thing. It was like this pathetic Groundhog Day over and over and over again. And you guys tell me to get a sponsor, and you tell me the men work with the men and the women with the women, and the men will pat your ass and the women will save it. So I asked this guy named Paul Mattson to sponsor me, because whatever. And he was this funky, eclectic, leftover hippie from the 60s. And he had long gray hair, and he wore bandanas and all of this turquoise jewelry, and he had these black glasses he would push way down on his nose, and he spoke with this really Shakespearean English accent, even though he's from Englewood. And I love that man. Like, he had this ability to raise his voice just a little bit louder than the noise in my head, and it seemed like he would tell me to do things that had absolutely no relevance whatsoever, like they didn't seem like they were going to fix the problem. Like, why do I have to go wash coffee cups? I'm like trying to figure out how to move out of my car. You're not listening to me. What does one have to do with the other? And then I would just go do what he said, and my life started to change. And I love the Al-Anon women in my home group, because they used to bring all of their Alateen's clothing that was too offensive for their teenage daughters to wear. And I would come clippity-clopping in these little mini skirts with these low-cut shirts, and I wore these hooker heels and these fishnets, and I had that 1980s flash dance hair going on. It's a vision for you. And I would just like get up and go outside and smoke and go get coffee and come back and go, I gotta go pee and I gotta talk to you because you guys are reading these things and I've memorized them. Like, just, I gotta say something. And one day I got out of my chair and my sponsor put his hand on my leg and he shoved me back down into the chair. He goes, if you get out of that chair one more time during a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you better have piss dribbling down your leg. And I was like, like, he embarrassed me. I was so mad. And I got up one time to share, and I go, my name's Tina, and I'm an alcoholic. And he stood up and went, that's all you know. Sit down now. I was like, you beast. I had 30 days sober, and I got up, and I was going to, like, lay on some young people stuff for you, because I'd been to rehab, and I've been to the psych unit, and I've been through therapy, and, like, I went to AA and NA and CA and whatever A, and I was going to, like, share with you why it was okay for me to share about alcohol and drugs in a meeting, just because you're old. Like, I'm going to bring you guys up to speed. And I started talking really fast, and my sponsor started doing that squiggle thing, and he stood up and he goes, you're finished now. And I, like, looked at my old-timers. I'm like, are you going to let him do that to me? Like, love me until you can learn to love yourself. Like, that's not loving. You got to stop him and shut that down. And they're going. And so I was left there that night. I was going to call New York and turn him in. I'm shutting the Alano Club down. We're going to, like, revoke your sponsorship licenses. You guys are doing it all wrong. And then I had 30 days. Like, I walked in one day dressed like a hooker, for lack of a better term, and my sponsor goes, would you wear that to church? And I said, well, no, sir, I would not, but there's like a dance after the meeting. He goes, I'll be damned if you'll wear it to mine. Go change your clothing. And I've never had a man go tell me to put more clothes on in my whole life. Like, I didn't even know what to do with that. And I went out to the little trunk in the trunk of my car, and I got some clothes, and I came stomping back into the meeting, and I had no idea that by making me change my clothes, he was teaching me a little bit of dignity and a little bit of grace and a little bit of self-respect, like how to carry myself like a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know he was doing that, and I was angry about the actions that he was making me take, but they changed the way that I viewed myself. And when I came to you guys, I used to stare at the ground, and you guys put me at the door, and you made me your greeter, and you'd come in, and I'd punch you in the arm, because I didn't want you to hug me, like, you can't get too close to me, so I would sock your frail little arms and leave these big old bruises, because you're all on blood thinners, and I can't look at you, and like looking down, hi, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I changed my clothes, and I realized, like, a couple weeks later, you guys would walk in, and I would hug you, and I would look you right in the face, And I would say, like, "Hi, Frank, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And he would look right back in my eyes and he would say, "Hi, Tina, I'm really glad you're here. And I had no idea, like, that I was going to be able to start forming relationships with you. I didn't realize, like, when I came to you, I was dirty on the inside and I was dirty on the outside, and I hated the woman that I had become, and I felt guilty and remorseful and full of self-pity, and I couldn't stand myself. I couldn't stand myself. And by taking actions that seemed to have no relevance whatsoever to the problems going on in my life, my opinion of myself started to change. And I think basically it was because, like, I could see myself for the first time reflected back in your eyes." And that's such an amazing gift to be able to give somebody. You know what I mean? So I stayed sober, and I had that sponsor, and I started working the steps, and he made me serve you guys. First, he made me your ashtray putter out her person, and I would show up early and put two ashtrays equally from the ends of those long tables so your little osteoarthritic arms could hit the ashtrays with your cigarettes. And then he made me your coffee cup washer, and I would go and I would wash the coffee cups. And then he stood up and made me shut up one time when I was at the podium, and I went into the kitchen and I washed your ashtrays first, and then I washed your ceramic cups in the dirty water when I was finished. Because I was going to show you. And I only did that twice because he made me apologize from the podium, and I hate that. And then he made me your coffee maker, and I would make this rank navy coffee that I had to serve toothpicks with so you could get the grinds out of your little black teeth, and come vibrating up to me after the meeting and go, "Good navy coffee, baby girl." Then you go stay up till Tuesday. I just wanted to share the experience with you. And I thought he would fire me and give me a better position, like your treasurer or something. And he did. And then I stole your money, and then I had to pay it back. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want you to hear this loud and clear. Like, I've done absolutely everything that you could possibly do wrong in here over the course of 31 and a half years, except for one thing. The one thing that I have not done wrong in 31 and a half years is I've not woke up with whiskey on my breath. And I have walked through the trials and the tribulations that are life in sobriety, sometimes with grace and dignity, and sometimes not. Sometimes not with grace and dignity, and that's not even a requirement. The requirement is that I walk through this crap without picking up a drink, and sometimes the grace and dignity for me has to come later. Like, of course it's preferable, because it looks better. But I'm not a graceful and dignified woman a lot of times when I'm walking through the crap. I stumble and I fall down, and you guys pick me up, and you hold me up when my knees fail to do the job oftentimes. And I started to build this life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked up and I went to take my cake the day that I had 2 years sober. It was October 10th of 1986. And I was going to the 11:30 meeting, and you guys came out, and you got all stupid close to me in that way that still makes me want to, like, punch you in the throat today. And you tell me my sponsor had passed away that morning, and I thought, like, I can't stay here without that funky old man. And I got another sponsor, and that sponsor made me serve Paul's daughter. And I buried her father, and I planned his memorial, and we took care of his financial stuff because I was working for him, and I did things that I didn't think that I was capable of doing. And I buried that sponsor, and I had another sponsor, and I had children, and I got married in that order, because whatever. And I built this life in here. You guys, I went to school, I bought houses, I bought cars, I had these children, and I got married to the man of my dreams, and we moved up to Northern California, well, kind of Central Coast-ish. We were living in Hollister, and we were up there for about 11 years, and I was like in the middle of the fellowship in Hollister. I loved my life in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of a sudden my sober husband decided to start riding with some rather unsavory characters that wear red and white patches on their back, and he rode off into the sunset with the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club when he was about 18 years sober, and I gave my eldest born to the United States Navy as my ninth step amends because I'm quite creative. and Matthew was in Iraq, and I couldn't get a hold of my oldest son. And he's in southern Iraq, and they're blowing up the prison that he works at on a continuous basis, and I can't get a hold of my kid, and my husband's riding with the Hells Angels, and he's having a affair with the bartender at Payne's, and my little 15-year-old is so mad at his dad that he starts quitting all of his sports teams and dropping out of school, and my whole sober life when I had 21 and a half years sober was crumbling around me, you guys, like crumbling around me, and I was hanging on for all I was worth, you know what I mean? And if you guys will just do what I tell you to, I could pull all of our lives out of the fire. Just like watch my counterclockwise rotating eyeballs, like do what I say. I'm trying to like self-will run riot everybody in my life into doing what I want them to do so I could pull it all out of the fire. And nobody's listening. And when I had 21 and a half years sober, that husband left. We were losing our house. My youngest son was running away, and Matt's drunk. Well, he wasn't in Iraq anymore. He'd come back to Bahrain and then subsequently to Japan, and he's drunk in the Navy and getting in trouble all of the time. And I'm losing my mind. You guys, I'm losing my mind at 21 and a half years sober. Like, and I caught this little resentment against this loving father that you guys had introduced me to and spoon-fed a relationship to me with, or with me to, or frickin' whatever. And I caught this resentment against God. And I there's a line in step 11 in the 12 and 12 that says that sometimes the hand of God seems heavy and unjust. And it's during these times that new lessons are learned and new resources of strength are uncovered. And it goes on to say that all of us at times are seized with a rebellion so sickening that we simply refuse to pray. And I stopped praying and went about trying to fix my life. And what wasn't already like in smoldering ruins at my feet, I smashed. At 21 and a half years sober, I was standing on a bridge in Northern California thinking, like, I'm not going to drink no matter what. Like, one day at a time, I'm going to stay sober for the rest of my life, but I can't do this anymore either. And I thought maybe the jumping looked like the easier, softer way. And I did one of those foxhole prayers. It was the same one that I did when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous to a God that I didn't even believe in anymore. And I asked for help. And I walked off that bridge, certainly not under my own steam. And I called this cantankerous beast that works in a mission in downtown Los Angeles that sobered up with frickin' Moses, for crying out loud. And he told me, 11:30 Tuesday, my office, kid. And I drove almost 400 miles, and I sat across the table from Clancy at the midnight mission, and I asked him to help me. And I think those are the most powerful words that we can utter in Alcoholics Anonymous, or will you help me? And Clancy started having me take actions that, like, ironically, weren't anything that I wasn't already doing anyway. Like, the requirements that I place on myself as a sober member in Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing are far less than the requirements that Clancy has of me as one of his sponsees. But all of a sudden, the actions that I was taking were no longer my own idea. And I was accountable to another human being. And Clancy made me stay in Northern California for a year and a half until my youngest son graduated. And then he let me move back to Los Angeles. And I moved down there to be near my sponsor and in the center of my home group. And I started to rebuild my life down there. And most days, certainly not this evening, but most days, you guys, I feel like a kid in a candy store. Like, I love my life. I love my life in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. My little drug addict high school dropout guy just graduated from high school by the skin of his teeth, and I left both my kids in Northern California and moved back to Los Angeles. And Dylan called me about 6 months later and asked me if he could come home. And he was strung out on a little bit of cocaine, and he was about 20 pounds underweight. And I put him on a bus, and I told him, like, you can always come home. You just can't get high in my house. And I picked him up from the bus station on Mother's Day weekend 5 years ago. It's coming up. Picked him up from the bus station Mother's Day weekend 5 years ago, and I took him up to the Mountain High Conference. It's this little Pacific Group conference that we have every year up in Big Bear. And he got to hang out with Polly Pistol, and we played volleyball and softball and basketball and whatever. We play a lot of games up there, and we have great speakers and whatever. And I stood back and I watched the young men in my group do what the young men in Alcoholics Anonymous do. And Dylan met the brother of my choosing, who was Frank Jones, and he told me that he wanted Frank to mentor him, and he wanted to be a Marine. And 6 months later, he left for boot camp, and he went through infantry training battalion, and he was picked up by the motivators at 8th and I in Washington, D.C., and for 3 years, he was on the silent drill platoon, like when you turn on your Denver Broncos game and you see those United States Marines out there in their dress blue uniforms spinning and throwing those rifles at the halftime show. That was my baby. And a week and a half ago, he got home from his deployment, and he's up in Northern California this weekend with the love of his life, who he's going to marry next year. And he's been with her since he was 15. And I'm so proud of that young man. So proud of that young man, and there was absolutely nothing that I could do on my own to help him. Like, I had to open my hands and give him to you. And your fingerprints are all over his life. And a little while later, that drunken Navy sailor guy that came back from Iraq with a little bit of post-traumatic stress and certainly a different man than the one that I sent over there picked up a little 5-year recreational black tar heroin habit, and he was homeless in Santa Barbara. And he ended up, like, up in Shasta or something with no money and a broken-down truck, and he called me up and said, like, Mom, I need some help. And since my first camping adventure went so well with my youngest, I picked Matthew up, and I took him on this little camp out that we were doing up at Mono Hot Springs, and he detoxed up in the mountains, and he was an absolute beast to all of my sober friends. And when we were coming back down the mountain, he had gotten himself a sponsor and said, if I'm going to do this 90 meetings in 90 days crap, I suppose you better show me where to go. And I took my son to all my home group meetings for 2 weeks, and then I stopped going to all of them except for two and started going to different meetings so that Matthew could have the experience of being a newcomer in the Pacific group. And August 29th of last year, I got to give my young man his one-year cake, and I got to tell you, I'm so incredibly grateful for that sobriety, as grateful for his as I am for mine. And one more time, it's your fingerprints all over everything that matters in my life. I love this deal. It seems to me like it's not until I'm able to bring to you the things that I treasure and hold the most dear and open my hands and let you have them. It's not until I'm willing to do that that you can take them from me and fix them. And I also know that God can't fill a closed fist. So I love this life. I'm going to tell you one story and then I'm going to sit down because I have 2 minutes left. When I was 13 years sober, I went on this cruise, and it was the night of my 13th birthday. I took my husband on this cruise, and we went down to Ensenada, Mexico, and I had fought this concept of a power greater than myself all my life, because the truth is if I believe that there's a loving power that wants nothing but the best for me, it's almost incumbent upon me to turn my will and my life over to the care of that power, and sometimes I just don't want to. And so I fight, and then I surrender, and then I fight, and then I surrender, and the night of my 13th birthday, I was standing on the deck of this cruise ship, and I was all dressed up. It was Saturday night, and we had just come from dinner at the captain's table, and I was all dressed up, and I looked beautiful, and I was standing on the deck of the cruise ship, and it was a full moon. It was a beautiful night, and there were all of these wispy clouds, and there were like a million stars, and looked like every single one of the white caps coming off of the ship had a light underneath it. It was just magical. And I was standing there and I was talking to all my old timers and Alcoholics Anonymous that had passed away. And I was telling them, like, oh my God, you guys, whoever would have thought that I could have a life like this? And just like they were all standing on the deck of that ship with me, I could hear them all say, we did, baby girl. I know that Paul Mattson looked at me on the 10th day of October and he saw a sober, dignified woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that my mama Helen looked at me and she saw a mother. And I know that Frank and Francie Priest looked at me and they saw a wife. And I know that Mike and Norma Ensign looked at me and they saw a daughter. Like, you guys looked at me and you saw all these amazing possibilities in a drunken little homeless girl who thought there was nothing available to her. And I think that you breathed every single one of those things into my very being, like you guys created me from nothing. And if I live to be 100 years old and I do nothing but serve Alcoholics Anonymous every day for the rest of my life, I could never, ever repay you for the gifts that you've given me. But I promise I'll spend the rest of it trying. Thank you guys for having me.